Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefeo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Good evening and welcome to Feed Your Head. Tonight it's my pleasure to have Nigel Watson with us. And I'd like to say hello, Nigel.
Hello. Hi.
And you're coming in. It's 1 o'clock in the morning in the UK. So thank you for staying up.
Okay.
Yeah. Nigel is an expert in ufology. And you have been doing this for years and years.
Yeah.
How did you first get interested, Nigel?
Well, it was in the late 60s with the Apollo moon landing missions. I started getting interested in the missions after Apollo 8 went round the moon. And then I started cutting anything I could find out about space or anything out of the newspapers. So I was a bit of a pest at school because I remember seeing the teacher pick up the newspaper with a really big hole in the front of it. And then because I got interested in the moon landing and things like that, I started getting books out of the library. And in the same section were books on UFOs, really. So I think the first sort of books I read were like books by George Adamski and the Contactees. People, mainly Americans in the 1950s, have said they'd met aliens who looked very much like us and spoke to them and had trips on board the flying saucers, that sort of thing. So they were quite amazing stories, really, but they were, I suppose, very much of that period where, you know, space exploration was beginning and, you know, people were fascinated by UFOs, really. But I think ever since then, contactees have always been a sort of controversial area of ufology because, obviously, the early ufologists were really interested in the sightings of lights in the sky and, you know, saucers, really. And so, you know, they just wanted to scientifically prove that UFOs existed. And then there were people coming along saying they've spoken to Venusians and Martians and, you know, visitors from Saturn and Jupiter. And, you know, attracted, you know, a lot of publicity for themselves and their books.
Right.
And it kind of undermined the sort of scientific attempts to make ufology a sort of serious subject. But over the years, I think people have kind of looked at the contactee stories again, and there's quite a lot of interest about how they came about. And in a way, they're told similar stories to abductees nowadays, really.
Yes.
About the warn of, you know, the things that earthlings are doing to the planet. So in a way, however true or not contactees were, they're always aware of Earth being part of the universe or the solar system and a place that, you know, our science was able to do a lot of damage to, basically.
Yeah. It's, but you know what you're saying, like they used to, like you said, the contactees or those who claimed they were contactees, they, you know, people thought they were just nuts and looking for a little bit of publicity.
Yeah.
But there's been more and more, like you said, and I think that, I can't think of their name, was it Betty and Barney or something? I mean, it sounds, who were one of the first couples, I believe.
Yeah, Betty and Barney Hill, yeah.
Yeah, at least more famous than others. But a lot of the things that people have said, and now it's easier because we have instant communications and all this. But back then, you were getting the same stories from different people in different parts of the world who had not communicated. And so right there you think, well, okay, there is something going on. I mean, they've had similar experiences. Would they just be having similar dreams or just making up the same kind of thing? Not necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's something that, you know, because the contactees were largely people like George Adamski, an American, and they wrote books about it, there's still contactees in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they kind of got overlooked, really, or, you know, because the material wasn't translated into English, we never become aware of it. Whereas, you know, now with the internet, we're probably more aware of things that are going on internationally. But
right.
In a way, the Betty and Barney Hill case in the 60s was virtually brought about the full awareness of the alien abduction phenomenon, because they were driving back to their home in Portsmouth and were followed by a UFO. And after looking at the craft and apparently seeing creatures inside it or beings, they drove off in a panic, and then they got home 2 hours later than expected. So there was that period of missing time, and that's often the main clue to whether somebody's been abducted or not after a UFO sighting.
Right.
But obviously all of this was sort of new to people in those days, so I think the serious ufologists who did sort of initially investigate the case didn't really know what to do with it, really, and kind of sat on it. And it was down to a journalist, really, to write about their experiences and to publish a book called The Interrupted Journey, which made it a worldwide phenomenon, really. But even then, it was several years before people really regularly started reporting abduction experiences like that.
Well, and it would make sense that the serious scientists didn't really want to do too much with that, or at least publicly do too much, because they thought it would, there again, they would lose some credibility.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that makes total sense. You wrote your first book about it, I believe, in 1990. Was that?
Yeah,
group?
That's true, yeah.
Okay, that was Portraits of Alien Encounters.
Yeah, that came out of quite a few different things I've been doing. Originally, I'd just started interviewing people who lived locally and just saw lights in the sky and things. And then I sort of spread my net to the rest of Northern England, really. And what happened was Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of a Third Kind came out. So there was a lot of publicity surrounding UFO sightings then. So I got passed on a lot of cases. And what we called then high strangeness cases, I actually went to interview people who said that I'd either a close encounter or I'd communications with aliens.
Wow.
So I got to meet a 12-year-old boy called Paul Bennett, who lived up in near Shipley, and he had a group of friends, and they often, you know, what they live quite near the moorlands near there in a reservoir. Mm-hmm. And they saw like a mini man in black cross the road once. On another occasion, they saw a 12-foot high green robot that seems to be scooping soil from the ground.
Oh my God! Okay,
and that was mixed in with a few poltergeist reports and ghostly sightings and things. And part of it might have been childhood imagination, but is you know, over the years, it's still kept a strong interest in the subject.
Sure.
And I think where often people don't just see a UFO, they often experience lots of other paranormal events that run through their lives. Often, you know, they might even have a memory of a sighting or an encounter when they're like only 4 or 5 years old, and then throughout their life they seem to get plagued by UFO sightings or alien encounters. So I think at the time we used to call them sort of repeater witnesses, you know, because some people just seemed to, it didn't matter where they went, UFOs or aliens would follow them.
Right.
And Paul Bennett was somebody like that.
Well, what about, you know, we hear that in this country when the Spanish explorers came to the islands, that the natives didn't see the ships because they had nothing to compare them to. What about that? When you're talking about these repeat sighters, if somebody sees something or has an experience when they're 3, 4, 5, then they may be more prone to, as time goes by, they have more encounters because they're open enough to that.
I think that's true because often young children see ghosts and see other things and say, and say it in a rather matter-of-fact manner. You know, my daughter was quite young when she used to speak to someone called Toby, and then she picked up her toy phone one day and said Toby's dead and put the phone down, and that was the end of Toby. But quite spooky, really, in the matter-of-fact way that we can have imaginary friends or interact with.
Well, that's it. I think that the imaginary friends are frequently not imaginary. But I think a lot of kids then that is sort of, it's talked out of them because their parents say, well, you're just imagining that, and they start in, and the kid gets a little older, and you know, it's like, well, that's enough with your imaginary friend, now you've got real playmates. And so they sort of put that in the back of their mind, maybe.
Yeah, I think the problem with human beings generally is that we're not very good at perceiving things. We're conditioned to perceive certain things, and as you get older, if you say you're in London, if you see a flash of red in the distance, you quickly assume it's a double-decker bus coming. And it's a bit like, well, with ufology, things have changed a lot. In the sort of 50s onwards, we were called flying saucers, and people, even though the first sighting by Kenneth Arnold in 1947, he only described their motion as skimming across the sky like saucers. And he sort of described sort of delta-shaped craft rather than the saucers how we imagine. But, you know, for some reason, you know, the name flying saucer stuck. And people reported seeing flying saucers how you'd imagine them to look, or how they're usually displayed in books and, you know, films at that time. But in a way, because we're in the sort of space age, we sort of regard them as craft from outer space. But before then, Foo Fighters were seen during the Second World War, which were balls of light that seemed to follow aircraft during the theatres of war then. And, you know, they were regarded as secret weapons by the enemy, but both sides saw them. And but they weren't linked with extraterrestrial craft. And like before then, mystery aircraft were seen in the period between the First and Second World Wars. So anything strange then was a mystery aircraft.
Right.
Before then, we had the phantom airship scares. One of the biggest was in America from 1896 to 97, when literally thousands of people reported seeing lights in the sky that they thought were linked with phantom airships, you know, created by some inventor working in a workshop in secret who was about to sort of revolutionise, you know, air transport. But obviously, well, quite a few people did come out of the woodwork to say they had invented the Phantom of the Skies or whatever, but none of their claims were really credible, and usually, you know, they never came out to actually display the craft to prove for certain that it was them flying in the sky. Mm-hmm. And also, like ufology today, a lot of people reported actually meeting the occupants of these airships that had landed in front of them and told them, you know, how the craft miraculously worked by these rotating blades and fantastic, you know, forms of propulsion that were, you know, obviously impossible. So,
right.
So in a way, ufology was almost started in 1896 in America, but in the shape of, you know, phantom airships, really. I don't know whether, in some ways, you could say, well, you know, that was created by, you know, newspaper hoaxes and people just misperceiving objects in the sky. You know, obviously there are lots of things in the sky,
sure,
you know, that can make you think you're seeing something strange, really. Yeah.
But you mentioned the late 1890s, and that was the time that there you read articles that mention some newspaper in the western part of our country, and I don't know, I think somebody told me it was Kansas. I thought it was further west, but they mentioned just casually in the newspaper that a body had been found in somebody's field, and they just said it's not of this earth.
All right, yeah.
And they just let it, you know, it's like, so that's the same time period you're talking about.
Yeah. There was a famous case of a in Texas, where a phantom airship was alleged to have crashed into a windmill, and that the body of a pilot was found, and there were hieroglyphics written on the wreckage, and seemed to indicate it was a sort of Martian. But some people say it was written in a rather tongue-in-cheek fashion, so and people say it was the product of a liar's club. But people have tried searching in the cemetery for the remains of this person, or you know, Martian or whatever it was, mm-hmm. but you know, nothing's turned up, really.
Right.
But there were quite a lot of stories like that of you know, meteors crashing and then the rocks split open to reveal an alien or something. So that sort of idea was around and was repeated a few times. There were a few other crash stories of phantom airships crashing or people finding wreckage, but often people put this wreckage on display and charge people so much to look at the wreckage.
Yeah,
you know,
a bit like people
do with crop circles now, if you know what I mean.
So,
but in a way, it kind of had all the elements of modern-day ufology, but in the context of phantom airships. And, you know, I think some people have said it was possible there was a secret inventor responsible for some of them. But I think, you know, a lot of them were due to people in cities looking at Venus or some prominent star or planet. And, you know, just a mass hysteria really created some of these scares.
Okay, sure, that makes sense.
I think the problem with that is that often these sort of scares start with some really credible cases.
Yeah.
And then you have a few hoaxes coming along, and then it's just easy for the media to say, oh, it's all a hoax now, and then it's all swept under the carpet. And, you know, people conveniently forget the cases that began the scare, and it couldn't be explained, basically. So,
right.
You know, I think that's a problem with the media, really. It always moves on to other things quite quickly, really. So something that will hit the headlines one day will soon disappear, won't it? So,
right. Well, the media is just there for the flash, and they don't delve into things deeply.
No.
They don't know. I'm speaking with Nigel Watson, and you can find him on Facebook. He is the author of his latest book. It's called UFO Investigations Manual. And we were talking about your 1990 book. After that, what have you written between?
Well, after that was called Portraits of Alien Encounters.
Yeah.
And then I went on to look at historical cases like the Phantom, the American Phantom Airship Scare, but I concentrated on the British cases, where there were airship scares in Britain. There was one in 1909 and one in end of 1912 to 1913.
Oh.
And so the book, it's called The Scare Ship Mystery, and it looks at airship scares that occurred in Britain, USA, Canada, South Africa, basically from 1909 to 1919. And in contrast to the American airship scare, the British scare in particular was more concentrated on the fear of German zeppelins coming out to spy upon our territory in
okay.
preparation for war. So there's a lot of fear associated with sightings of airships, and also they were seen all along the East Coast, where you'd expect the first wave of German invaders really to the
sure.
country. So and then the spread to sort of South Wales, virtually every part of Britain. But there were still quite a few intriguing cases there. There's one case on Caerphilly Mountain. A man was coming home one night when he encountered what he thought were people speaking in a foreign tongue, like German, in a wicker basket beneath a sort of balloon or something. And then when he came upon them, they quickly flew away into the sky, illuminating the ground with an electric light, and there that was assumed that it was a sort of German airship. But it was very rare in those days for anyone to fly at night as well. And when they came back to the area, they found the ground had been disturbed with marks showing that some craft had taken off. And also there's lots of bits of newspaper about airships and flight all over the ground, but the witness seemed quite convincing, and it was an early case of what we call a close encounter of a third kind in Britain, really. Mm. And in fact, it's actually covered in the works of Charles Fort, who wrote the Book of the Damned, and quite famous books about Fortean phenomena. So that's one of the most intriguing cases from 1909.
Wow.
And in 1913, there were literally hundreds of sightings of lights in the sky and the sound of engines in the air associated with the lights. And then during World War One, there was quite a lot of similar sightings, but often people thought that there was a sort of German aircraft hidden away in the countryside operating at night, and that
yeah.
spies were signalling to it,
Yeah.
So, but all of those, usually on further investigation, they never really tracked anything down to any, human cause.
Right. Well, and you mentioned Germany a few times. I think that the Germans were way ahead of the rest of us. I know after the Second World War, the United States brought a lot of, Nazis and other Germans over here, and they actually worked on the space program for the United States.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I think that they were ahead of the rest of us.
Yeah, well, we're certainly ahead of us in terms of, building airships and zeppelins
mm-hmm.
during the First World War. And then there were quite a lot of stories about, the Germans had developed flying saucer craft, and that, the knowledge of this technology was mm-hmm. taken to the United States and secretly developed.
Right.
But it's hard to pin down, because a lot of these stories are often based on sort of information that's fragmentary or a bit
right.
it's not always that credible, really. It's hard to really pin down the evidence for it.
And if there had been, like, some type of contact or something made in with the Germans way back, then when they came over here, they would have brought that with them.
Yeah.
So,
it's quite interesting, though, that when flying saucers first hit the headlines, this was one of the first things that the American government did, was to check out German technology, and actually they did have agents trying to find out information about if any German craft had been built like that, and they actually spoke to one or two of the Germans who'd been involved in building sort of flying saucer shaped craft, but they'd only built a couple of prototypes which were very sort of basic. I think they were Horton brothers in particular had developed one of these sort of circular craft, but they'd had a lot of problems with it, and basically they didn't have time to develop it properly. But I think agents on behalf of something like the FBI or the, it had been investigated anyway, but we couldn't sort of, it didn't seem viable compared to the stories of how fast flying saucers were seen to move in the United States, really, compared to what they'd built. So, in a way, I don't know whether the German connection is a red herring or not, but some people like to think that there's a heritage of sort of German technology that might be linked with communication with aliens as well. You know, that was a connection between them.
Right. Well, now I know that you have a book coming out next year. It's about the World War II UFO. I mean, World War One UFOs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And History Press is publishing that. But what about the one that just came out, your UFO Investigations Manual? Tell us about that, Nigel.
Well, it came about last year because I went to a lecture about the space shuttle, and it was published by Haynes, which in Britain are well known for publishing motoring manuals. You can say you've got a Mini or a Rover or something. You can buy one of these manuals, and it'll tell you how to change the oil.
Yeah.
So we've got a long tradition of building and making manuals for car maintenance, basically. But we've decided to spread to other topics like the space shuttle and lunar modules and even imaginary things like the Death Star in Star Wars.
Oh.
And so I put forward the idea of doing a UFO Investigators Manual, which they were quite keen on. But originally it started off as an investigator's manual, where it would just sort of outline everything that you should collect and do if you're actually investigating a UFO case. But in a way, I thought that was a bit restricted, and some people obviously go into great detail of, you know, what sort of equipment we use and things, whereas other people might only want to do newspaper research or look in files and things. So this book, basically, I cover everything from the airship scares and the aircraft scares from 1892 to 1947. And then I look at the official UFO investigations that were conducted after Kenneth Arnold's flying saucer sightings. And then I look at how we've come to classify sightings using Hynek's scheme of close encounters of a first kind, second kind, etc. And also at the physical evidence for these different types of cases, the different types of close encounters there are, and also a look at how the different theories about the where UFOs come from is explained as well. And then at the end of it, I give a bit about how to produce a UFO investigation report and the sort of investigation kit essentials, and a little bit about sky watching as well. So I think, you know, writing this book, you realise how many areas the book covers, really, because you can go from everything from the sort of psychology of perception to, you know, metallurgy, meteorology, you know, astronomy, you know. So it's just a broad church, really.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think it's quite, in a way, ufology isn't the sort of scientific subject in itself, but it does open up areas of scientific examination, really.
Right. I mean, there's so much that's connected. So it's not just real straightforward. You have so many things. I know that we talked a bit about the abductees and contactees.
Yeah.
But how do you identify a real UFO? I mean, real being, I guess, subjective. How would one say, okay, I know? Because, like, in my heart, I know I saw one when I lived in the West.
All right.
But
yeah.
But it was so far away, but, and not being of a scientific mind at all, I just knew that no, I mean, it did this whole 45-degree thingy and almost probably backwards a little more than 45. I mean, it was just so strange. But how would you, what do you require to say, okay, you know, yes, we accept that this person did see a UFO? How do you identify?
Well, I think there's sort of four main areas that I've identified, which are man-made terrestrial objects like aircraft, balloons and drones, and Chinese lanterns as well. And then the natural terrestrial phenomena like mirages, clouds, temperature inversions, swamp gas, which is famously been used as an explanation, lightning, ball lightning, plasma balls, reflections. Those are all sort of natural terrestrial phenomena. Then there are stars, planets, sun, moon, comet, that sort of thing, or you know, natural celestial phenomena. And then there's man-made celestial objects like satellites and rocket re-entries, and you know, anything that's really falling from the sky that's been, you know, spaceships and that sort of thing, but, you know, built by humanity.
Right.
But all of them have a different characteristics, really, and often it's very difficult to separate one from another, really, because especially if it's just a light in the sky that you're seeing in the distance. Several years ago, I saw some lights in the sky with several other people, and I was in a car and we stopped in the middle of a road, about two or three other cars stopped behind us, and we all watched these lights in the distance, and it just looked like a classic lit up flying saucer coming towards us, and it was like a scene out of Close Encounters. But then as it got closer, we could hear the throb of these engines, and it was one of these a blimp, advertising blimp. But it looked so convincing. If we'd not got out of the car and heard the engines, we'd have, you know, I'd have been convinced we'd seen something, really, you know.
Right.
So often, I think that was a basic problem with anything seen in the distance, really, because, first of all, it's hard, especially at night time, to judge the size of an object. Say, if you see a light, it could be really close to you, or it could be, you know, miles away. You know, stars are obviously, you know, light years away, but the, you know, some that if they're bright, you might imagine are only just above your house, really. So I think, you know, that's down to problems of human perception, really. We're not very good judging size and distance, and even trained people, can have similar problems. You know, obviously we're probably in a better position than most of us, but often, you know, we see UFOs when we least expect them, you know, if you're driving along at night. And also, I suppose most of us don't really look at the skies that much, really. So,
right.
You know, when we do, you know, like the other morning, I was just coming home and I just looked up, I caught a meteor streaking past, and they happen so fast, they do make you jump. And even if you, you know, and I think somebody who might not be that aware of meteors might think, oh, you know, it's something, you know, a lot stranger, really.
Exactly. I love meteors. I mean, I just love to watch the meteor showers and everything. It's, I don't know, magical to me, even knowing that it's some kind of space garbage, like some people say. But I don't particularly care for that definition because it's magical. Yeah. But I see what you're saying. But what about like hot spots and portals? What are those, Nigel?
All right. Well, in Britain, Warminster's a very famous hot spot of UFO activity. In the sort of mid-1960s, people started seeing UFOs there, but it was kind of triggered by mysterious sounds and flocks of dead pigeons being found. So it started off with a few mysterious events, then the kind of UFO situation sort of kicked in. And Warminster's in Wiltshire, which is not that far from Stonehenge and Avebury and Silbury Hill, you know, quite famous prehistoric sites. And so it's already got a sort of mystical ambience to it. And also there's quite a few hills nearby, particularly Cradle Hill, that you can actually walk up. And it's a good viewing place. And it was dominated by someone called Arthur Shuttlewood, who was a local journalist who collected all these stories and wrote them up in a quite well-known book called The Warminster Mystery. And it also, there were photographs taken of what they called the Thing, or the Warminster Thing, which were published in the British national newspapers. So it came, you know, it was a place that attracted lots of ufologists, and people would spend a lot of time on Cradle Hill sky watching. And quite a few places like this occur throughout the world, really, where people are attracted to a certain spot because there are lots of sightings. But also, you often need somebody to promote these cases as well. Or, you know, to get you need to have sort of a lot of media attention,
right,
you know, to attract people there, as well as the UFO sighting. So it's hard to know which came first, the UFOs or the media, you know.
Okay, yeah. I have heard that, because there's a United States a naval base in the southwestern part of Puerto Rico.
Oh, yeah.
And I have heard that there has been a lot of sightings in that area, and they think that that is one of the places where there's been contact made.
All right.
You heard about that?
I think I've heard a bit about Puerto Rico. I know there's certainly those, is it Chewbacca's or whatever? I'm not sure what they're called now, but the sort of mysterious entities have been seen there as well. Often UFOs are seen in association with all sorts of strange things. I mentioned the 12-foot-tall robot, but you know, people see winged entities and ghostly creatures, all sorts of sort of robotic-looking things, as well as, you know, the normal alien-type things with the large heads and slanted eyes, really. So, in a way, I think these hotspots, though, you know, some of them might be media-generated, or some are areas which seem to have a history of mysterious lights and weird events happening. I think in America there's several locations where Native Americans have regarded as sacred because of mm-hmm. legends mm-hmm. of lights and encounters with beings from the sky at these locations.
Right.
And then when the pioneers have come along, they've also noticed strange lights and phenomena at the same locations. It's a bit like the Bermuda Triangle. There's certain triangular areas throughout the world which seem to have these kind of
energy, and energy. It has a different kind of feel about it. What about the people who say that the story in the Bible about Ezekiel?
Oh, yes.
And seeing the wheel in the wheel, and they say, well, you know, like, let's get real here. We're talking about some kind of alien spaceship because, you know, now they're finding more and more evidence of, we've heard about the Anunnaki for, you know, a long time.
Yeah.
And how now I just saw something recently about some kind of DNA that's been discovered, and they're talking about 400,000 years.
All right.
That there was something similar to us. The stories go that we are geoengineered,
right.
That the story about Adam and things, that this was what they called the race, the Anunnaki created. I don't know, I mean, how far back this would go, but if you, you know, start to, it starts to make sense that things are not what they seem or not what we've been taught,
yeah.
And that there's been activity on this planet way, way, way before any mainstream religion or anything would want us to believe.
Yeah, I think we've always been influenced by things that go on in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've talked about the airships and mystery aircraft,
right.
But way back before then, we had, you know, reports of dragons in the sky and flying
mm-hmm.
shields,
mm-hmm.
and people have actually seen all sorts of sort of events happening in the sky that were often portents of doom or things that are, you know, going to, important things that are going to happen in the history of a world or of our country.
Or have. I mean,
yeah.
Like the, you know, wars in the skies. The Bhagavad Gita has, you know, talked about the wars. So it's nothing new, but what it seems like once something clicks in our brain, then we look at everything in a different way.
Yeah, I think that's true because, you know, obviously with the Bible, it looks at strange events in terms of, you know, religious intervention, and other, you know, holy scriptures also refer to strange phenomena that we'd perceive, you know, in a sort of UFO point
mm-hmm.
of view. But in a way, things are changing, or have changed, and that, you know, from when I was interested in UFOs, it was mainly about, you know, whether there were spacecraft or not. But, you know, the whole subject is divided into lots of sub-areas, you know, like
mm-hmm.
crop circle research,
yes.
or
yes.
the whole thing about disclosure,
yes.
and whether, you know, the governments are actually hiding information about UFOs. So, you know, there's so many different areas, and like a lot of people now think that, you know, UFOs have been involved in our evolution for, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years, and that they're sort of pushing us along
mm-hmm.
an evolutionary path.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not too certain how true that is, but I think, you know, these sort of things have influenced us because, you know, UFOs, we're still talking about them now, even if we don't believe in their existence or not. You know, you can't go anywhere without seeing UFOs and aliens, you know,
yeah.
and in the cinema, on TV, advertising, packaging.
Well,
you know,
I think that more and more people are actually believing. At least I've been finding that. I've been finding in the past couple years, and in fact recently, it just almost knocked me out, people who maybe 5 or 10 years ago would have poo-pooed the whole idea. Now they are saying, well, it only makes sense that there's other intelligence. And I mean, you know, they're coming around. And I find that very heartening.
I think one of the things is that, you know, most astronomers will agree, you know, just by the sheer size of the universe, that, you know, there's got to be other intelligent life somewhere, because, you know, there's simply billions of stars, if not billions of galaxies. So it'd be a bit improbable if we're just the only fluke in such a vast universe. And also, we're finding exoplanets surrounding other star systems as well. So, you know, that indicates that there's plenty more planets where life can evolve, really, but it's not just a theory anymore. That, you know, there again, that's another part of a jigsaw of finding extraterrestrial life. But I think what happens really with ufology is that it's rather given short shrift by astronomers, because they want to remain scientific, and you know, they don't want to be painted with a brush of ufology. And I think that's one reason I've written the book, really, because I think the problem with, if you just surf a net, it's very difficult to get an anchor on the subject of ufology, because there's so many websites and so much information. It's hard, you know, even if you know a lot about the subject, some websites are don't seem to have any relation to the sort of subject you know about. So in a way, my book is a good sort of guide to the whole subject, and as a sort of an entry point to the whole subject, so that then when you are looking at the internet or reading the book, you can sort of, if you want to focus your interest on, you know, hot spots or official investigations or going out and doing your own interviewing and investigating, you know, this is, will act as a sort of, you know, a handy resource, really, because I think with some organisations, they just only concentrate on one aspect of a subject.
Right, but your book, UFO Investigations, is it Investigations Manual or Investigators?
Yeah. Okay. Investigations.
Right. At one point it was Investigators, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was going to be just but we kind of broadened it out, really, because I was sort of interested in the sort of history and evolution of a subject, really, and also, I suppose, with the different types of explanations for UFOs, it's a way of widening it out to show, you know, where the subject might be going as well.
Well, it's very comprehensive, like you said. I mean, you're covering so many of these interrelated topics.
I think the problem is it's very difficult to cram everything in, though, because it's such a big subject. Because
well, you've got to do a part two.
I was in one of the pages of a book. I look at some of the psychological processes that have been put forward to explain UFO sightings or abductions, and they include things like sleep paralysis, fantasy proneness, hallucination, false memory syndrome, temporal lobe epilepsy, psychological trauma, you know, and, you know, the list goes on, really. So even say you don't believe in alien abductions, there's still a lot of research somebody interested in psychology could do, or you could look at how, you know, the media deals with ufology, or, you know, there's still lots of areas that you can study, you know, whether or not UFOs are spaceships or rare plasma phenomena or time travelers or recently an old theory has been revived of considering whether UFOs are actually biological beings that live in the higher atmosphere.
I think I've missed that.
Yeah. somebody called Trevor Constable in the 60s used infrared film to take pictures of UFOs, and he regarded them as biological. And it's quite interesting that recently scientists have found sort of living organisms in the higher atmosphere, although they're obviously not big enough to cause UFO sightings. But
right.
It's just interesting that the old theory that the that there could be sort of things living out in the atmosphere that could cause UFO sightings, and it might also explain why some UFOs seem to interact with witnesses and signal to people. But I think it's still quite a far out sort of idea,
right.
but you never know, really, do you? It's
the topic is boundaryless, really. I was going to ask you, I have read that some of our former and maybe current astronauts have seen things that several of them say, I mean, without a doubt, they have either encountered beings from elsewhere or evidence of beings from elsewhere, so that they seem to not have any qualms or any doubts about it.
Yeah, I think there's I think a few astronauts have sort of come out to say that they believe in mm-hmm. extraterrestrial life, and there have been, you know, a lot of stories of UFOs being seen in association with spacecraft. Mm-hmm. Some of them have been explained as bits of
space satellite or something. Yeah, something that we have put up that dysfunctional at this point or something. But I believe recently, and I can't think who was it, a former member of the government in Canada has recently just come out and has been talking about disclosure.
Yeah, I think quite a lot of people have sort of discussed disclosure, but it's very difficult. Like, a lot of files have been made public in Britain, in the mm-hmm. United States,
right.
Australia is another country where a lot of files have become available. But, and obviously a lot of attention is attracted to the United States, really, because, you know, of the Roswell crash and the fact that the wreckage is kept at Area 51. But I think one problem is trying to track down disclosure is that there's so many government departments, and often one government department doesn't know what another government department has done. So sometimes, some secret operations can cause UFO sightings, and also, a lot of files from the past, like in Britain, were just routinely destroyed just because they didn't think they were significant. But, you know, obviously to us, we'd find them really valuable now.
Yeah, when you think back about that kind of thing, you just want to scream. It's like, oh, my God, why didn't they hold on to those? But
it's quite frustrating, really, because, there's so many different departments and you don't really know where to pin it down. I think that's a problem, particularly in America, where a lot of people have tried finding information, and mm-hmm. it's mainly through ex-military personnel and a few people.
Well, that
like
was
astronauts.
My very first exposure was, I was a teenager, and I don't know how I managed to get a hold of, because I lived in a small town, but I got a hold of a book that was written by an ex-Air Force person. Some kind of a major or something. I can't remember the name of the book. I can't remember his name. But it was about UFOs. And it just, opened up my world.
All right.
So I don't know, because the people that I was around weren't into that at all. It was not part of their whatever. They didn't care. They were doing other things. But after I read that book, really, it just sort of changed a lot for me. Are you there? I think that we've just lost Nigel. I don't know. Okay, Skype is trying to get him back for us. But he has had so much information here. His newest book is UFO Investigations Manual. And you can find him on Facebook. That's N-I-G-E-L, Nigel Watson, W-A-T-S-O-N. This does not look as if we are getting him back, though. We'll try for a little bit here. So we're just going to do a little bit of music. And
Oh,
there you are. Okay, yeah. You're there. Okay. I was thinking, okay,
there.
I don't know. I mean, Skype was fine, and then I heard that sound, and I thought, oh, my God, he's gone. But where is the best place to get your book? Is it Amazon or
Amazon. Apparently an American edition is coming available sort of in a week or two in the States.
Okay.
It is on the Amazon website there, yeah.
Okay,
it's
going to
be distributed.
Huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think something like the 13th of December, I think it says on Amazon.com, yeah.
Okay, so
I've had quite a lot of positive reviews. Everybody has seen it, really.
I have seen some of those.
It.
Yeah, I mean they say that there's so much there though. So
yeah,
I guess you had probably best start thinking about part two after you get this next book.
After World War One.
Right after the World War One UFOs comes out next year for History Press.
Yeah, I'd like to have done something more in detail either about abductions or. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence and the scientific procedures that are being used to try and actually find life elsewhere. But I think the problem with the scientific searches for alien civilizations is they always think of aliens as the same as us, really, that we're going to evolve in a similar way and have similar ways. You know, there might be intelligent civilizations that have never bothered with science, for example. So,
okay,
there could be lots of ways, intelligent civilizations could evolve and have certainly, a different biological structure altogether.
Yes.
So I think that's another obstacle, perhaps, to finding other forms of life. It's a bit like life on Earth, really. You know, would you bother trying to communicate with an ant, really, would you? You know, because there's so different different forms of life form that a highly evolved alien civilization might not even think it's worth bothering with us.
Well, that would be like if you sort of followed the idea that we were made hundreds of thousands of years ago as slaves to dig out gold and different things, that we were pretty low on the totem pole.
Yeah. Charles Forto has said that perhaps we are property and we are just like the pets of alien forces, really. Or like you say, we could be a product of alien DNA experiments or anything,
mm-hmm.
really. We still don't really know how life came to come into an existence on Earth, really.
No.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, dinosaurs existed here hundreds of millions of years ago and they died out.
Mm-hmm.
And so the planet has been habitable for millions of years, but we've only been in existence for a few hundred thousand years, really. So, how we came about is still a sort of big mystery, really, isn't it?
It is. It's just sort of wondrous when, you think about it and think about the steps. They may seem large or small to us, depending on our perspective, but the steps that we're making and how people are beginning to accept us, well, more than beginning. And I think it's just, I'm fascinated by it. But
I think that's the other thing about ufology. It opens up so many ideas.
Yes.
You know, that's the thing, really. I think that's what helps people.
Well, it helps us grow. I mean, people are growing now in ways that, sometime back would have been, people just didn't think this would happen. It wasn't in their vision. So I think it's just a wonderful thing and a wonderful topic. And I hope you'll come back.
You know
so much about it. Yeah. So I've been talking with Nigel Watson in the UK. Find him on Facebook and Amazon, because this man writes what he knows, and he knows a lot. So thank you so much.
Okay. All right.
Bye-bye.
All right. Okay. Bye.
Bye. You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Hello and welcome back to Feed Your Head. Tonight we have an pre-recorded interview, and we've had some trouble with it, so I hope it's all going to work now. Patrizio Beckerly is here, tonight we have with us, I hope I don't mispronounce his name, Patrizio, oh goodness, I'm going to, just pronounce your name for us, would you please?
In German, it's Patrizio Beckerle.
Right. Patrizio Beckerle. So, you are in Austria, and I want to thank you for coming in to, you know, do this. We had to, like, finagle a bit, and it was easy, though. Thank goodness for Skype. One of your sites in English is rawhealthandhappiness.com. And then you have another one that is www.rohundfroh.eu, right?
That's right, yes. I made two sites. I started initially with the English version, and then I made the German version too. And
right.
They both relaunched last week and the week before, and
I know that this is a brand new one. You've been working hard at it, and I just admire the fact that you can do your own, so that's all good. Tonight, we're going to talk about veganism and Buddhism, and you are both a vegan and a Buddhist, and I would like to ask you, which came first?
First came the Buddhism. Oh. Buddhism was my entry door to everything. Everything of the mind, every place. I couldn't do anything of these things without Buddhism.
Okay. Now, did you grow up that way, or did you grow up with a different kind of religion and then you switched? What happened?
No, not at all. I'm Christian by birth, but my family is not very strict Christian, so I had no real confession, no real binding to Christianism. My coming out, I don't know how to call it, to Buddhism was when I stopped playing a computer game and wasting a lot of time with it, and then I started to shuffle all kind of information into my head. I read a lot and about so many delightful things, and after a half or three quarters of a year, I stumbled upon world religions. I wanted to know more about world religions, and I used a lot of audio university lectures about all major world religions, Buddhism was one of the last, Christianism, Judaism, Islam, and Hinduism. It was very interesting. There were a long series of lectures, about 30 to 40 lectures per world religion. And after I studied everything, it was clear to me my way lies on Buddhism.
No, I mean, you really searched it out as far as reading on different world religions. And I think that's important because I think when we study them, we find out that the core of, well, at least the core of all the religions and spiritual paths that I've studied or heard about, read about, the core is love and compassion and kindness. And we look around us and we see that, you know, not everybody maybe is walking their talk, but different religions or paths appeal to different people. So when you find something that resonates in your heart and soul, well, that's definitely where you should be. So how long have you been a Buddhist then, Patricio?
I think it must be 7 years now.
Seven, okay.
I think it was easy for me because I'm very mind-driven, so I have to understand everything. I'm researching everything. I'll have to do experiments, and Buddhism is so clear. It's just pure logic for me.
Yeah.
And you can expand your mind and your heart to every being in the universe just by understanding how our nature works. It's easy.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, it's easy, or it's simple, and sometimes it's not easy. The two are not the same. But when you catch on to just a part of it, then things start to unfold, I think. And that was how you first, I believe, well, you started out like almost everybody in the world eating meat and dairy, And then, though, you became a vegetarian first, right?
That's true. I was just a vegetarian because of my misunderstanding about animal suffering. I read the book of Mahatma Gandhi, his autobiography, and he writes about vegetarianism, and then it suddenly became clear for me. That was, by the way, before I became Buddhist. Then it became clear to me that why do animals have to die because of my meals? It wasn't necessary at all, and it wasn't appealing anymore, and I stopped doing it.
Yeah.
That was one of the starting key points of my journey since then. That was about seven or 8 years ago, I think.
Yeah. But that was me decades ago. I mean, it was just easy to become a vegetarian. And like you, I didn't realize the horrors that the animals that give us the milk and cheese and all go through.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
I thought, well, as long as I bought eggs that were from cage-free chickens, but then, you know, then I saw what that means. And even from my local person down here, he was selling some cage-free eggs, which I bought. And he told me he had visited the guy who, you know, had the chickens. And he said, they're outside. And he showed me this tiny, maybe, 15 by 15 kind of plot where these chickens, that was them being outside. The thing was, he was getting so many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of eggs from them, like every day. It's like, okay, there's something wrong here. And that was, I just stopped the eggs. And then I thought, well, okay, this is really stupid. I cut back on cheese, and then I just stopped it. And cream for coffee. I mean, me going from vegetarianism to veganism was like the easiest thing I've ever done, I think. You know, I mean, once you understand, you don't want to take part in it anymore.
Yeah. As I said, it was just a misconception because I never researched anymore. I just at that time, I only wanted to make clear no animal has to die.
Yeah.
And if it is killed so I can eat, then I knew it had to die. I wasn't aware about the suffering in the dairy industry or egg industry or any other industry concerning animal produce products. So I didn't research this. I wasn't aware. I wasn't nutrition aware. I didn't thought about this either. It just was the thing. I don't want that animals have to die. So I was vegetarian.
Well, I think that's. I think a lot of people come to it because of the the animals being killed and suffering, and then later they find out how much better they feel, and then they start getting into the whole nutritional aspect. And then, you know, many also, I mean, in there, they're all combined for me. I mean, the saving the planet, and this is the way we do it, by not knocking down rainforests to cattle to murder, you know, that kind of thing. So it just sort of melds together. But like you, for me, it was first because of the animals. And then I noticed that I wasn't nearly as sick. I didn't get colds and all these things like my friends did, and the flu and all that.
That's right.
And it's like, wow.
Maybe you're vegan or vegetarian?
Yeah, I mean, either, but I'm vegan. It's just, it was so easy to go from being vegetarian to being vegan. Now, I'm not raw, and that's what we're going to talk about, or one of the things we're going to talk about, because you are raw. Am I right?
That's true,
yeah. Yeah. And how did that come about, Patricio?
It was very strange. Many, many things in my last 7-8 years of life were very instantaneous. Like this going raw, because, as I said, I had no awareness about nutrition or these things. I just wanted to be vegetarian, so no animal has to die, actually, so I can eat it. And then I was sick. I lay in bed, and a friend of mine gave me a video from an Austrian lecturer about the... It's in German, it's... Yeah, okay. It's called, like, the light about our nutrition in our life, in German, just. And it was about what happens in our body when we eat certain things and where our body tries to get all the waste products and shuffles stuff around so it can survive our eating habits. And then it all became clear to me. And I knew I have to stop this because it's just such a great experiment. And I'm very lazy about things and about nutrition, and I wanted to change this. And it came to me in an instant. And then the next day, I was still ill. I tried to change it, and it took only weeks or months, I think, until I stumbled upon the 80-10-10 diet. And after I read this book by Dr. Doug Graham, I everything was completely clear for me. I knew he was right in every line of his book, and even if I don't like what he writes, or if I find it inconvenient, it's nevertheless true. And so and so it was clear I have to do this, and it was very hard emotionally, because we have our habits and they stick. They stick.
we do. And it is. We might mention that the 80-10-10 diet has to do with 80% carbohydrates, 10% oils and fats, and
oil.
Right, and 10% protein.
It's actually 80 or more percent.
Right.
Of carbohydrates.
Right.
From fruit, majorly. So no starches or such thing, because it's hard to digest and have to be cooked most of the time. But okay, starches would be okay in, let's say, a pumpkin or something. And 10 or less percent from fat, plant fat, no oils because they're refined and not...
Well, right. So that would be the difference there, right.
10% is not very much because even a banana has a few percent of the calories in fat, and protein is the same with protein, 10 or less percent of proteins, which is enough.
Yeah, which is actually pretty hard to get less than 10% protein because, like, a tomato has, what, 14% or... I mean, you know, people don't understand that fruits and vegetables do have...
They do, yes.
Yeah, and I mean, everybody... Well, a lot of people realize that avocados and nuts and olives have the fats, but... You know, everything seems to have a tiny bit. So it's not, once you concentrate, I think you're pretty balanced. I do know a lot of people who are vegan who are not necessarily healthy because they still eat a lot of processed foods. And, I mean, it's true that what they eat, no animal had to die for or be abused, but they eat a lot of things that are very processed and have a lot of unnatural things in it and everything. So once you go raw, or even like myself, who I don't eat processed foods, 1% out of 300 or so. I mean, I just really don't because I know what's in it. And like they say, if you can't pronounce it, you don't need to eat it. You know? So,
like Doug says, if it comes in a jar or something, then you don't eat it.
Exactly. So, but then when you go raw, and I know there's people who say, wow, you know, what? So you just eat apples and pineapples all day? But you have wonderful meals because I've seen pictures on Facebook in a couple different groups of vegans, and you have a lot of variety, and you take these beautiful pictures. I mean, anybody looking at those would say, oh, yeah, I mean, I could do that. I could live on that, I think, you know. How did you start with your cooking? I mean, did somebody show you? Did you look at YouTube videos? How did you get into this?
Frankly, I just use what I have. Okay, after doing it 2.5 years, it gets a little easier. You internally know what fruits and what veggies will combine. It's not everything does combine it.
No.
So the first year it was my experiments were not all the time very lucky, but the last, let's say, half a year, it's everything I do fits perfectly. It's very, very seldom that I produce something that's not tastes not very delightful. I posted photos from what I made.
Mm-hmm.
English Facebook album, and I got a little resonance, but more interesting was that there's a lot more resonance on the German-speaking room, so I started to post things on German too, but very seldom, once a week, every 2 weeks maybe.
Oh.
Now I post every day, so I get maximum resonance, and the people like it a lot because they get inspired, and that's the...
Exactly.
Most important part, inspiring other people to try out new things, to see new things, and
that's Well, now, what would you say would be the most important cooking? Well, not cooking. preparing tool or utensil or something in the kitchen for you?
Oh, the most important is there is no most important, because you can always eat the fruits straight, like they came from the tree or from the bushes. So you don't need everything, but it's nice to have a lot of items.
Mm-hmm.
Like a high-speed blender. You can make very creamy sauces with a high-speed blender, and it's just nice. It's nice to have, and it's very important to keep you happy. So I always try to keep me happy, because fruit food is no comfort food. So I have to be delighted from the things I make with fruits. And so I have some tools like a high-speed blender, like my Blendtec, or like the spiralizer. It's a wonderful tool. If you want to have noodles, you can make noodles out of a lot of things, like butternuts, pumpkin, or daikon radish, or zucchini. It's an awesome tool, and the people like it. They like to use it, and they get to grasp the concept of raw food, because they say, you can make noodles, and it's great, and they try that.
It looks like fun. I don't have one. I've seen it. It does look like fun. So, I mean, that is on my list. Now, you live in Austria, where it gets pretty cold.
Yes.
And I understand when, you know, we have so many vegan friends who are living, like, in Thailand and different places in Asia. They've got fresh fruit year-round. What do you do? I mean, is it hard there? Is all the everything's imported in the wintertime? Do the prices go up? I mean, what's it like?
No, it's no real problem. You can. There are many Canadian guys and girls who are raw foodies. It's no problem. Like you said, you can import everything. Carbon footprint will be much, 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 much less still than if you eat any meat or dairy products, because of all the feeding and so on. So it's okay, and prices are not that high. Of course, I like summer because it's warm and there's a lot of more sun, and I have my garden with my own fruits and veggies, which is very important if you want the highest quality. You can produce your own things, but it's no problem. Bananas, and you have all kinds of fruit, and I have at least 10 types of different fruits in winter laying around and waiting to get perfectly ripe.
So you do grow your own in the season?
Yes.
You grow quite a bit then in your own garden, which is good. Do you preserve it in any way? Like,
no.
Do you dry it or can it or freeze it or anything?
No, not at all. I just use what my trees and bushes provide me, and I have still some grapes outside, and I have still some tomatoes outside and such thing. And there will be many more things next year, because I've planted a lot of new trees and bushes, and I have a small glass house built a month ago or so. So I will start early next year, and so many more experiments. I love it.
Wow. No, you're very fortunate that you have the space, so you can grow not just a garden, but you can do berry bushes and trees and things.
I'm fortunate, true.
Really? What would you say to somebody who lives in, like, Austria or Canada or here in the States, and it gets really cold, and they don't have a lot of money, because money plays a part, too. You know, are they just supposed to eat apples and carrots all winter? Or, I mean, how can they keep a diet from boring them to death? And I mean, what can they do?
It's first thing, it's important to have fruits. You need to have fruits if you want to live a fruitarian-like lifestyle. You need fruits. Then they have to be ripe, so you have to get the knack about it. How they will get riper, then you buy it because you almost every time buy unripe fruits, so you have to ripen them yourself, and it can need several weeks till they gain peak ripeness, like persimmons or kiwi fruits. I have lying kiwi fruits around for 6 weeks now, and persimmons 4 or 5 weeks, and they're still not every persimmon is ripe, so it needs some time. You have to think in advance. You can't go to the store, I want to have fresh fruits and I want to buy them now. That definitely doesn't work. Bananas, you need several days, up to a week till they arrive, so you can't just go to a store. But right. There are stores which sell ripe fruit, pre-ripened fruits, and that's okay too, of course, but if you want to get cheap, I always buy if they are cheaper, if there's a special offer or something, I get I get 15, 20 kilograms or maybe 30 pounds or something from fruits, and I have sit them around. I have some in the cellar for later ripening. I have them in the living room or kitchen for faster ripening. It's very important to keep you happy.
Yeah. Well, that's funny you say that, because like in the living room or the kitchen or wherever you have room, I have a friend in England who's a fruitarian, and he recently remodeled his home. He got another house, actually. He moved in. He remodeled the kitchen. And there's no cooker. You know, there's no cooker. There's no fridge. He has counter space like you wouldn't believe. He sent pictures out. I mean, lots and lots of counter space, Patrizio. And, you know, fruit everywhere. So you understand. I mean, when if you're ripening something in your living room, I know you understand. That's so funny, though, because, yeah, you get the deals when you can, and then you figure out how to keep it, or maybe you overdose on a couple of fruits for a week or two. This is personal, but do you live alone?
I live alone, yes.
You live alone. So you haven't had to do battle with anybody in your own home.
Fortunately not.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be very easy. If you have another fruit here, of course, the ideal thing would be many fruits living in one flat or house or something. It would be ideal.
Yeah.
But it's not that crazy. I have a lot of stuff lying around in the kitchen, of course, but it's very nice because I can get excited about ripe fruits, and so I'm surrounded by beautiful fruit all the time, and it's very uplifting.
Well, I think it'd be great to wake up in the morning and look over there and a bunch of tomatoes on the dresser or something. I mean, it's like, okay, well, this is good. I like that. So what about your family, though? Your family and your close friends, have they seen your way, or do they think you're crazy, or do they just, what do they say about your eating?
They all know I'm different and I do different things because it seems like I love doing different things. I love to swim, not all the time, but I'm a conventionalist against the stream swimmer, I think. Sometimes I try to be a bit conventional, but most of the time I do things other than other people. So it's okay for them. They know that they know that I know what I'm doing, because I'm thriving with it. I get fitter every day, and I'm getting healthier every day, and I'm full of energy, and they like that. But they know they can't do it because it's far too hard to them, and they have the it's not their life. They have their mind on other things, but they have one sister who was with me at the 3 to 4 days camp this year in Slovenia, where Dr. Doug Graham was there, and she still is very high raw. She switched to veganism from being an omnivore to veganism, plus very high raw. So
wow, okay.
She eats cooked vegan food, and sometimes I think there is still some normal conventional food mixed in, because it's not everywhere it's easy to get non-vegan food, and I brute force this. I want to do raw veganism, and so I do it, but if you don't have the 100% commitment, it's not very easy.
Yeah.
For business life or something, it's very inconvenient often.
Yeah, the raw, I mean, it's, you know, we can all miss a meal here or there if we're in a situation where the only food is, you know, McDonald's or something, like, gag me. But, I mean, for a long period of time, yeah, we do need to eat, and we might not be in a position where we should fast for a week right then. So we have to find something. But then when we go back, our bodies are just so grateful. And so that's
I
don't tell people they have to be 100% pure 100% of the time, because that's just scary when you say, I will never eat anything cooked again. It's like, wow, okay. I have friends who say, well, if there's a family birthday party, I may do this or that. And in fact, this summer, one of my friends went to a family, it's a kid's party, I guess, whatever, and ate a little bit of ice cream and knew he shouldn't. He did. He got so sick. And it's like, yeah, well, you should have, you know, because I know as a vegetarian, I got sick about 3 times when accidentally I ate something that had been made like with meat broth or something. And something had, I guess, bits of meat or something. I got really sick. And I've heard about that. They say that when you stop eating it, your body then isn't willing to digest it again. And it, so just for me, I mean, just the fact that it would make me ill would be enough to say, okay, I don't want that. Some people, I guess it doesn't affect. They'll eat it and then they go back to being vegan or vegetarian and they're fine. But I was going to ask also how a lot of Buddhists I know are vegetarian, as a lot of Hindus are, but they're not vegan. The Buddhists that you know, are they vegan mostly or not?
Most of them not even vegetarian.
No, wow.
It's a contradiction for me.
It is.
I can't really. It's one thing can't go without the other thing, because if you claim to have compassion about all living beings, you definitely have to stop to eat them or wear them or something. So it's I don't quite understand it. But even the Dalai Lama isn't a vegetarian, so, and he's the impersonation of compassion. So this is one point I don't quite understand too.
But yeah, I admire him greatly. I have met him
too.
The Dalai Lama, but I always, you know, he was a vegetarian. But then a while back I read something that even he was because of whatever illness or something, then his doctor had recommended that he eat
no red meat,
fish or something every week or every couple. I mean, and it was just like, oh no, you know, he knows better. So that made me feel really bad. So I thought that even his doctor is not aware. So that to me is really strange. I have a friend who's involved in the Krishna consciousness movement, and he's vegan hardcore, and he's very upset with the people who are vegetarian in the movement and not vegan, because he says, well, this is hypocrisy, you know. And so, I mean, everybody though is on their own path, and we know that all the paths are trying to get to the top of the mountain, but it does get frustrating, I admit. Do you go to like public meditations and things, or do you practice Buddhism more on your own?
Most of the time I'm practicing at home. It's Buddhism is a view of everything for me, and it's a tool set. I use the meditations and all kind of stuff. I'm using that as tool, and I use it every day. I have to use it every day because it's part of me now, and it's not very often that I go to public meditations or groups or something, because I always have to do my own thing, and when I want and when I need it, especially. And
exactly.
So it's my own stuff. I have a group. It's a Kamakachi group, but I'm not a very a Mahayana or Vajrayana kind of Buddhist. I don't have a strict lineage I'm following. Maybe I'm more Theravada, I'm more logic-driven and down to the point, and I need no visualizations or something. It's more like I have to understand it very deeply and act like it.
No, visualization is a strong point for me. I mean, I'm very good at that. I tell people that Buddhism saved my sanity at one point.
Of course.
You know, I don't know. I mean, things were so strange in my world, and just by reading and practicing certain things, I came out on the good side. And so, I mean, I'll always be grateful for that. I don't know if you, are you familiar with the name Pema Chodron?
Of course,
okay. Yeah. one of her books almost hit me. I was in a used bookstore, and there was a table of, used books, okay, they're even, you know, they're less expensive, and then there was a table there with even less expensive, like used books on sale kind of thing.
Awesome.
And there was this book there that was well used. It was called Start Where You Are. And, I mean, my hand, there was probably no way I could have kept my hand from picking that book up. And that did it. I mean, I have most of her books. I think she's wonderful. She's taught me a lot. And there's a few other Buddhist teachers, too. Jack Kornfield. There's a lot that they have so much to say in such a gentle way. And I think it's I think the world would be much better if we had more people practicing.
Of course.
You know, that's my view on it. But what do you think, besides just living your life, you know, as you do privately and all, what are some of the ways? And now you have the website, so you're talking a lot about food on the website. How much do you talk about the spiritual path?
I chose the name because I want to do it, and I want to connect the two things together.
Okay.
If my journey leads me to this, right now I'm getting so much resonance from the food part, so I give the people some food stuff because it's on my own mind too, because it's an interesting journey, and reporting things is very useful for mankind, I think, even because it raises the consciousness. And the spiritual part, it has to fit in there someday. It's not easy to talk to talk about meditations, because it's another big leap of our mind, and people don't like big leaps of mind and changing of habits and doing meditations because you need them. It's not very, very appealing to people. It's even easier to get a vision to raw veganism than to get a spiritual non-practitioner being a practitioner.
I
have no clue how to raise consciousness about this at the moment, so
mm-hmm.
a lot of stuff.
I think you're right, though. Well, for some reason, people are searching, but we are creatures of habit. And so, yeah, something has to just sort of shake us a bit and break that lock.
Yeah.
So if you say that people are more apt to, like a vegan would be more apt to change to raw than to decide to meditate. what kind of meditations are your favorite kind?
Most of the time I do samadhi meditation or vipassana. It's just getting my mind clear or processing things on my mind, and it's to realign my own view and don't get too overwhelmed by worldly concerns, because ultimately I just want to be a hermit and and have a clear mind, which isn't very easy because I'm involved in so many things and so many flows, which are great but worldly, and that's a problem, because if it's something is worldly, you drift away from your ultimate reality.
Well, that monkey mind.
Yeah, of course, monkey mind.
Yeah,
it's all the time, monkey mind, very fast.
Yeah, it is, because for whatever reason, we're just consumed by it, really. And so I think a lot of people also are put off or scared by even the word meditation, because, they think that they have to have a room dedicated to this, and they have to wear certain clothes, they have to have certain candles, certain incense, certain music, all of these things. And like we both know, those are fun. They're tools. They're, again, and if, if a certain piece of music gets your mind right into that frame, that's great. Use it. But don't think you have to have all these things.
True.
You can meditate in your bedroom. You can meditate in your yard. You can meditate on a train.
It would be a great start to slow down, to start doing things consciously. Mm-hmm. We are doing things in such rapid speed. We don't paying attention to what we do, and it's a bliss to stop and do every hand movement very consciously, so you can follow every tension of your muscle and so on. Even this would be a great meditation. You don't actually have to sit for it. You can do it in your daily work. Just start doing things consciously, but.
Well, preparing the food is a fantastic way to get in touch. And I mean, because you're already been in touch with nature, and particularly like you, when you grow your own, I mean, you grow it, you pick it, you wash it, you chop it, sterilize it, whatever. And I mean, it's all that connection.
True.
So, have you ever or considered, like, I know with the website, this is a form of being a coach, But have you ever thought about, like, person to person or Skype to Skyping, person to person, coaching people?
Of course, I'm very sure it will come in the future. It just started to evolve. It's only a few weeks ago I knew I have to do a new website and things will unfold for me. I'm very sure of that. If I can be of more service, I will. Certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't asked you that before, but I was pretty sure that this is coming. And I think you're going to be very good at this. You're going to help a lot of people, Patrick, because Patrick, I'm going to call you Patrick. Yeah.
Call me Patrick.
Patrizio. Yeah. Patrizio is like, well, Patrick.
Well, Patrick too. It's
okay. Pretty close, huh? But it is something that, well, you're very passionate about. And so you're going to, and you have the knowledge and firsthand experience. So now you said you became a vegetarian about 7 years ago. When did you become vegan?
I was a normal cooked vegan. I switched from vegetarian directly to
raw food.
And then raw food is my,
yeah.
I kicked the vegan part.
Yeah. So to raw vegan, about how long have you been totally raw?
Totally, it's a hard word because I'm doing this since 2.5 years, but
okay.
I like to experiment. So all the time, all the last 7 years, I always did counter experiments to prove that it's okay what I'm doing. So I did things that are not okay to prove that it's okay, because if I see a very dirty reaction of my body or my mind when I did things with my mind, then I knew, oh, yes, it's true. Because when other people say, don't do this because such and such, it's okay, nice to hear from me, and maybe I'm even resonating with the words, but I like first-hand knowledge.
Right. No, that's true. So you're experimenting on your own body. Do you have any kind of test done by your doctor or a medical person? I know some vegans do that every year or so.
Not yet, because I'm not the doctor kind. I don't like sitting and waiting at doctors. And right now my body is so sensitive to everything. I can't imagine. I wouldn't know if something goes amiss. I can't imagine, because it's stating very, very, very clearly, you have to rest, you have to do this, you have to do this. I'm so full of energy, and I'm training, working out every day almost, and I would know. I would know.
Yeah. Well, what kind of workouts do you do?
I'm doing lots of stuff. Most of the time I'm doing what my body demands, what muscle is able to do more work, because I worked the day before.
Right.
So I mean,
well, some people use like no weights or nothing like that. They just like free form exercise. Do you do that, or do you have weights? Do you go to a gym? Do you have machines?
Well, my family is very unsporty, so My body is very, I think if someone with better genes would put this effort into his workout, he would look differently. But that's no problem for me. I'm training a lot, and I like my body. I like it feels when I train. I do lifting weights, and I do things like Taibo, Philipp Lenz. I'm doing that since about 10 years since we have it in Austria.
Wow.
I'm doing like PT 24/7, his new program. I'm doing a P90X from Beachbody and P90X 2 and Turbo Fire, and I'm doing a lot of yoga, and I'm like I said, I do all kinds of things in the summer. I'm doing everything outside, and it's a lot of fun to
jump
around and do training and carry things around and balance on things. I try to work on every part, on speed, endurance, balance, flexibility, strength, everything, because it all fits together. It has to fit together. It's
sure.
No,
it's all connected. But you're with exercise like you are then with the food. You want that variety, that diversity, so that you're not going to get tired of something.
Of course. And the experiments, of course, because everything I do is an experiment for me.
I love that.
I think it's interesting for me.
Right. Well, you're keeping it real for you, and yeah, because you want to keep learning too. And like you said, I mean, you know, stand, and then you can tell people, well, okay, this is what worked for me. It may not for you, but this worked for me. So I know what that person was talking about. I think that's excellent. I want to give again your website. In English, it's rawhealthandhappiness.com, and in German, I'll spell this rohundfroh.eu, and you're also on Facebook, and if anybody looks up several different vegan groups on Facebook, they'll see your beautiful pictures also, but they're on your wall. I mean, you really have great food, and you make it look very good. So you've got that artist's eye there. So people say, well, wow, I never thought about that before, but hey, that looks so good. I'm going to try. So
the funny thing is that I just learned by doing it, because I'm the complete other side around. Normally I didn't pay any attention how my food looked, so I make it look better so I can present it to the rest of the world.
Exactly.
Kind of interesting. You know, everyone is telling, it looks so great, and I'm only smiling.
I mean, that's true, though. That like at home, it may not, we just may throw something together. I don't want to say throw, but you know, I mean, but then if you're going to show it to somebody else, you want it to look nice. And anyway, yours always look great. So I want to thank you, and I hope you'll come back, Patrick. Patrick, I'm doing it again. Patrizio, I'm sorry. Patrizio. You have so much to tell us about, like, spiritual paths and veganism, because they are, at least in your case, totally intertwined. And I like that. You're definitely walking your talk, my friend. So thank you so much, and have a great weekend.
Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to listen to the show, and I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay. Good night. Thank you to Patrizio McCurley and to Nigel Watson. Have a great weekend, everyone.